Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, as well as economist Diane Lim, for our new segment, The Economist Mom. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. House Republican tax writers approved a second round of tax cuts in a partisan push timed for the November elections. In party line votes, the House Ways and Means Committee approved three bills to build on last year's tax code overhaul. These measures would make permanent the tax cuts for individuals currently set to expire in 2025, while offering incentives for retirement savings and help for startup businesses. The Joint Committee on Taxation recently concluded that the three bills taken together would increase annual deficits by over $650 billion during the next decade. The measure is due to get a vote in the House this month, but is unlikely to pass the Senate. A quarter of the annual spending bills have now made their way to the White House. This marks the first time in a decade that Congress has passed three spending bills on time. Just a reminder, that's 3 out of 12. With the White House signaling that President Trump will sign the measures, House leadership has not wasted time in calling this a return to regular order for the long-broken appropriations process. It might be a little soon for that, considering a four-bill spending package, which includes the Agriculture, Transportation, HUD, Interior, Environment, and Financial Services bills, has hit a bit of a roadblock due to partisan writers. The House and Senate have come to a compromise on the two biggest annual spending bills in the hopes of passing the legislation funding the military, health care, and education in time for the new fiscal year that begins on October 1st. The compromise bill was made possible by the House negotiators agreeing to strip the bill of partisan policy writers, but the very thing that made it possible could prove its undoing, as House conservatives have threatened to oppose the measure as a result. President Trump has also sent mixed signals about whether or not he'd support the bill over funding for a border wall. The bill also includes a stopgap funding measure called a continuing resolution to avoid a partial government shutdown for any agencies that do not get their full year appropriations completed in time by extending current levels of funding through December 7th. Now that's the regular order we've come to know for the past two decades. The agencies at risk of going unfunded include the Department of State, Commerce, Justice, and Homeland Security. We'll go deeper into the appropriations drama and an analysis of the latest House tax bill with Bob Bixby up next. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. Bob is a recurring voice on the show. He lives off of TAB, Starbucks, and fiscal policy. Welcome back, Bob.
You forgot maple walnut muffins, but thank you.
You're right, Chase. You're right. For those who don't know, Bob also likes most things with a maple flavoring, including Shaw's maple walnut muffins. So, to cut to the chase, if you will, I want to cover a couple reports here. One is from the Congressional Budget Office. The CBO put out their analysis on what's been fondly referred to as Tax Cuts 2.0, also referred to as H.R. 6760 in the House. Bob, can you, for our listeners, give us a quick summary of what this potential second round of tax cuts looks like and what CBO had to say in terms of its potential cost?
Well, what the CBO said is that this package of tax cuts, which is mostly extensions of tax cuts that have already been enacted but are scheduled to expire in 2025. That was a budget gimmick to make last year's tax cut look like it would cost less relative to the deficit. So this is kind of making up for that and saying, well, what would be the, if you made kind of an honest tax cut of this and extended them for the full 10 years, how much more would this add to the deficit? And over the coming 10 years, it adds about another $631 billion to the deficit through 2028. And, you know, we're already projected to be running big deficits. So if you look at most of the cost of this comes in the latter part of the 10 years because that's when the tax cuts were scheduled to expire. So if you look at, you know, 10 years out, the budget deficit was projected to be $1.5 trillion in that year alone. And now it would be somewhere around $1.8 trillion. The more significant thing, too, is if you look at what would happen beyond this artificial 10-year budget, you know, window, and then there it would probably be extending projected budget deficits between $3 to $4 trillion, not even including the added interest. So it's a pretty substantial revenue loss from this tax bill.
Bob, I want to back up just a second here and talk about the bill itself and how the Congressional Budget Office got to its figures of around $630 billion in the cost of that particular bill. Does the CBO, at least in this instance, use, you know, what people refer to as dynamic scoring? Does it account for any kind of economic feedback?
This particular one does not, although at some point it will. The CBO works with the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is one of the committees of Congress that comes up with the revenue estimates for tax bills. And right now, they have not completed their dynamic score of the bill, but they are working on one.
Do you have any inclination as to maybe how they've used dynamic scoring in the past and how that might impact some of these numbers, or is it just too early to make that kind of assessment?
Well, I don't think it would have much of an impact because you're only talking about a few years towards the end of the 10-year period. And when they did a dynamic score of the full bill last year, it wasn't that dramatic. It did show that some of the revenue loss was made up for by a gain, but you still had a revenue loss of close to $2 trillion.
Would you consider this, I know you've mentioned this as sort of an impact on the back years or the later years in that 10-year window, would you consider this second round of potential tax cuts a big tax cut? Is it marginal in comparison to what, you know, the initial offering was from this last round of tax code overhaul?
It's a big tax cut. Certainly not as it's round two, literally, of what was enacted last year, and that's the way I look at it. As you know, last year was artificially cut off at a certain point so they could jam it into the budget resolution, and this is really, you should add the two things together and say this is the package that they were going to pass last year, but they couldn't quite get all of it, so they enacted a budget gimmick to see if part of it went away, and this is putting that piece back together again, which really means that last year's tax cut was really big.
And before I switch to the next topic I wanted to cover with you, Bob, why is there such a different dynamic? Why is the House pushing for or in favor of these, and it's likely to die in the Senate, as many have suggested?
Well, in the Senate, you still have the possibility of a filibuster. So that means that they would have to get Democratic support for the tax bill, and it's not there.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. We have been discussing the CBO's latest analysis of the House's second round of tax code reform or overhaul. And I want to shift gears now, Bob, to the appropriations process. Right now, we're coming to the end of the 2018 fiscal year going into 2019, October 1st. Can you give us a quick update on where we are in the appropriations process and maybe whether we're likely to see a shutdown?
Well, Chase, you know, the end of the appropriations bill might not be the most exciting thing going on in Washington this week, but it has some very big consequences, because if Congress does not enact a bill by the end of the week, that is the by Sunday, which is the end of the fiscal year, September 30th, then there'll be a partial shutdown of the government, because once again Congress will not have funded all of its appropriations bills on time. So there's kind of a race to see. The Senate has passed a bill that would keep funding going through December 7th, and the House needs to pass that. And it's not clear if the president will sign it. He sort of give mixed messages. He wants more money than the Senate has set aside for the border wall. On the other hand, it's not clear that the administration really wants to be responsible for government shutdown by vetoing bills that the Congress has passed, particularly before the election. So there's a little bit of a drama there as we head towards the end of the fiscal year, but overall things are a little bit better than they were last year, because they have passed some bills, and they're in agreement on a lot more of the bills, even if they can't get them all done by the end of the fiscal year. So the chances of a shutdown by the end of the week are pretty small, but they're not totally, you can't take that option off the table.
It's a really interesting dynamic going on, and an interesting situation from my perspective. I know we've talked in the past about how this fiscal year is a little different than past fiscal years, where there was a bit of more of a breakdown because sort of the wheels were greased in a sense, because they had a higher budget cap threshold to come in under for some of these appropriations bills. And I've heard, I've read that three of the overall appropriations bills are done, so they're about a quarter of the way there. And, Republican leadership is celebrating a victory of a return back to sort of regular order. But then, you've got what you just said, and that is, well, they're not quite there yet, and there's still a slim chance of a shutdown and at least a continuing resolution. So why do we have these conflicting messages going on?
I think it's coming from a, where you start. Kind of a question is that things were so bad the last couple of years that getting three of your 12 bills done on time is a massive improvement.
That just seems sad to me. That's crazy.
If you go back several years, that would have been considered a failure. Given from where we started, having three of them done, and the other there are other ones that are close to being done. As I said, the big one is the defense labor bill, which is like $850 billion. Those two bills have been packaged together. It's got the continuing resolution latched onto that to provide funding for the rest of the government through December 7th, and that's the one that will really determine whether or not we're going to have a shutdown or not.
So I've also got a curious question here. We've talked about the House and the Senate having sort of different pathways on some of these appropriations bills and how we have to have the reconciliation process to make those two paths meet. Who wins out the most in those situations? Is it usually the Senate, what they want and what is most bipartisan ends up taking control, or does the House get its way more often?
Well, I don't have a scoreboard, but I think the odds are with the Senate, because you do still have to have some bipartisan support. So long as you have the ability of the Democratic side or the Republican side, when they're in the minority, to hold up legislation and force 60 votes to proceed, so that means they have a little bit more leverage. Whereas the majority in the House, it's much easier for them to pass whatever the heck they want. I kind of like it when both sides have to participate in a bill.
And this is my last question for you, Bob, before we have to go. And I know we've got an election taking place between, the beginning of this fiscal year and the end of the next fiscal year and a whole other appropriations process to go. But I alluded to how the wheels were a bit greased for this year, and we still didn't quite get there on getting everything passed on time in sort of regular order. Would you expect for fiscal year 2020 a little bit of a bumpier road, or do you think we've turned the corner in some aspect of bipartisanship in this appropriations process?
I do not think that we have turned a corner, and I think 2020 will be a little bit bumpier, because 2019 they had agreed in a earlier this year on the total number for appropriations, and there's no agreement for 2020 right now. So we'll be back in a situation where who knows what's going to happen for 2020, and you have the possibility of, you know, at least the House maybe going to the Democrats. If that happens, that changes the dynamic considerably on what could get done. So I don't think we've turned a corner on the dysfunction that we've seen on appropriations bills.
Well, maybe one day we will. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. We've been discussing the CBO's analysis of the Tax Cut 2.0 proposal, as well as an update on this year's appropriations process. Up next, Bob will be back, and we'll be joined by economist Diane Lim for our newest recurring segment, The Economist Mom. Diane will become a Facing the Future regular contributor. We're really excited about this new segment. Bob, thanks so much for being on the show, and I'll hear from you in a few minutes.
All right.
We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by economist Diane Lim and Concord's executive director, Bob Bixby. Everyone's pretty familiar with Bob at this point, but Diane is only a second-time guest. She's currently a principal at the District Economics Group. She also teaches courses in behavioral economics and tax policy at George Washington University and Georgetown. She was Concord Coalition Chief Economist from 2008 to 2012. She's also been with the CBO, Brookings Institution, Pew Charitable Trusts, Committee for Economic Development, the House Budget Committee, and the House Ways and Means Committee. She certainly has quite a bit of experience. She received her PhD in economics from the University of Virginia, her master's from Brown, and she has a bachelor's degree from the University of Michigan. Happy to have you on the show, Diane. We're excited to kick off this new segment.
Thanks, Chase. It's great to be here.
And so I think before we dive into what this segment is and what it will be, I maybe give a little bit of background. This isn't the first time we've had a reference to the Economist Mom with the Concord Coalition. So maybe you can give a little bit of a history of the Economist Mom, why it's still important today even.
So I joined Concord Coalition coming from the House Budget Committee, where I've been chief economist for a couple years. And I wanted to write about why ordinary people should pay attention to what's going on with the federal budget and how it relates to our economy. And often I would find myself trying to explain what I did for a living to my mom friends. And inevitably, when they found out that I like to do research on the budget and the effects of budget deficits on the economy, they would ask me, well, what is the deficit? You know, is it really anything more than something that, you know, Capitol Hill pays attention to? Like, really, should we really care about this so-called budget deficit? So I decided that it would be a good idea while I was starting at Concord Coalition to try to communicate the issue a little bit better to ordinary Americans, and that would be in keeping with Concord's mission of promoting fiscal responsibility. Not just, you know, Concord doesn't just, you know, work with people on the Hill, with members on the Hill and the politicians. A key part of Concord's mission is connecting the grassroots, the general public, to the issues and getting them to speak up a little bit more about how they feel about the issues to their members of Congress, to their political leaders. So I asked Bob if he would be willing to let me start a blog called Economist Mom, because at the time I just thought it was cute that Economist Mom rhymes with com, and I was going to get an economistmom.com address, so I just thought that was cute.
I like that.
To this day, Phil Smith, one of our Concord colleagues, always says, oh, there's economistmom.com. I used to always tell him. That's the website.
Is it still on your license plate?
It is still. My license plate is Econ Mom.
Wow, this, you can't fit it. So this is almost like a defining term for you and what you do in your everyday work.
It is. I mean, to this day, even though I stopped, I left Concord in early 2013, I have never, and I stopped blogging, by the way. I only blogged while I was here at Concord. And, you know, Concord was incredibly generous with me to let me, like, spend so much time writing on that blog. And eventually we moved the blog to Concord's website. And then Concord got it started its own blog. So it's sort of like there was a transition when it was sort of just my own thing to something that was on Concord's site to something that Concord kind of split off and did. We had our own tabulation blog. The tabulation. Yeah. So, but wherever I went, I was still trying to hold on to that identity of Economist Mom because it worked well for me in terms of engaging the media and engaging kind of real people, people I knew not because of my professional life, but because of my personal life. It just engaged, got the attention of a lot more people. And it served us well at Concord because, you know, the Wall Street Journal, just I think it was within the first year I'd been writing the blog, the Wall Street Journal picked it up and put the blog as one of their top 10 or 20 economics blogs that were out there. And at the time, there were just, the bloggers were like Greg Mankiw and Brad DeLong. They tended to be, it was a very male-dominated field. And so I think it helped that I entered that space and identified as a mom. And so people just found that like unusual and something to pay attention to. So it wasn't just like I was any other old male economist talking. And to this day, it helps for me to call myself Economist Mom. I tweet under that handle still, at Economist Mom. And it really has helped me reach a broader audience than if I were tweeting just as an economist or if I were tweeting just as a mom. So there's something about that combination that is just there to remind readers or listeners that that what happens in the economy and what happens in public policy does impact all of our lives. And it's not just an abstract concept. It's something that we should be paying attention to because the economy is all interdependent. We're all, you know, part of this economic ecosystem. And you can't pull one part of the economy without it, you know, tugging on the rest of the economy. And so it has helped me to keep that identity up. No matter what job I've had professionally, I've tried to stay active on social media under that name because it gets a broader audience than either one of the names.
Well, we're happy to have the Economist Mom back in the fold, Diane, and I think Bob would agree with me. I think it's vitally important for what the Concord Coalition and similar grassroots organizations, what we do in terms of engaging the everyday American. So I think this is going to be an awesome segment, and I'm looking forward to jumping right into it. But before we do, just you mentioned the tabulation, and I have to put a shout out here. The tabulation is also a sort of a double entendre or a pun because Bob, our executive director, drinks a lot of Tab, which is like the first ever diet soda. So I had to put that reference in there since we're reminiscing about the history of Concord Coalition blogs. Why don't you, Diane, give us a quick overview of some of the topics you want to cover here in this this maiden voyage of the Economist Mom on Facing the Future, and then we can dive in from there.
Okay, well, I thought today I would talk about kind of the issue that I started the Economist Mom blog really focusing on, and that was people didn't have a good understanding of why the government borrowing money should be of concern to them. It's simply the idea that that a lot of people still hold on to, that somehow if government can borrow the money to pay for things, it's almost like it's free, you know, or politicians kind of act as if it's free money. This great new way to finance things. It's called borrowing. And it turns out that when you borrow money, the public doesn't care about it so much because you're not raising their taxes or you're not cutting their benefits. And so they like this thing called borrowed money. So I thought that I would go back to that sort of first lesson that I tried to get out in my on my very first post on Economist Mom, I talked about why the deficit was an important concept for people to understand that it wasn't. I spent a lot of time talking about how it's not free and that we have to pay the cost back eventually.
Diane, I think you're right. It's certainly not free money. This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim during our first ever The Economist Mom segment on Facing the Future. And I think maybe a good way to tee off the point you're making here, Diane, about deficits and tax cuts aren't free money is maybe we can dig deep on what might have been your first lesson. Like, how did you come to realize that point we have to have pay fors sometimes?
You know, I started out my career as my research was focused on tax reform issues. And the funny thing about tax economists is we are often trained to look at, to model and study the effects of tax reform in somewhat of a vacuum, in that a typical assumption in the models that I was using, building and using, was that any change in tax rates or definition of the tax base, any tax reform, in other words, would be assumed to be revenue neutral. And I actually had to make that assumption in my economic model, because otherwise the system doesn't solve. Like, there's not a determining equation that forces the other variables to settle into certain values. And so I had never really studied the effects of financing decisions. Like, I'd only studied the effect of, well, if we reduce this tax rate, we would raise the overall tax base to raise the same amount of revenue. And what would be the economic benefit of doing that? And economists like to focus on the efficiency gains you get from that, because decisions aren't so distorted by higher marginal tax rates. When tax rates are lower, people will not be so influenced by taxes when they decide how much to work or how much to save or what to invest in. Or where to live, or all kinds of decisions are less affected when marginal tax rates are low. But, you know, as a tax economist, I never really thought about, well, what if it isn't revenue neutral? So the first time I was actually forced to think about that was when I went to work at the Clinton administration for the final year of the Clinton administration for the Council of Economic Advisors. And I was senior economist for tax and budget policy. And I was essentially tasked that final year of the Clinton administration to write the section of Clinton's final economic report of the president that dealt with the legacy or the economic effects of his deficit reduction policies. So both his spending discipline, spending restraint, and the tax increases that had taken place during his administration. And they wanted me to study the evidence about the economic costs or benefits of that deficit reduction policy and write about it in the final economic report. So for the first time, I was, tasked with looking at deficit reduction as a policy in and of itself, rather than kind of distinct from how you get to that deficit reduction. So I was asked to study what are the economic effects of deficit reduction. And I had never done that before. I was brought on as a tax economist, and I didn't really have expertise in the effects of public financing on the macro economy. And during that year, I spent a lot of time learning about that relationship, deficits to the macro economy. And I learned that the problem with deficits is that they represent negative saving. It's what the public sector is saving. It turns out they're just saving if they're running deficits and they're accumulating debt. And then as soon as I focused on this is negative saving, I realized, well, that subtracts from private saving. And the sum, private plus public saving equals national saving. And for an economist, that was like a light bulb moment for me. It was like, oh, that makes it a lot simpler to think about it. It just adds up to national saving. And all economists are trained at a very basic level to understand that more national saving means faster economic growth, because it's what you're bringing forward into the future. If you have a bigger capital stock to work with, then each unit of labor is more productive because there's more capital to work with, and productivity goes up, economic growth goes up. So national saving is good for the long-term kind of supply side of the economy. So the primary reason why deficits are bad for the economy is they eat away at the supply side, because they represent negative saving. It takes away from national saving, and so it takes away from the resources that we have to carry forward into the future. So it reduces our economic potential going forward, and it's about the supply side of the economy.
And just when you think about an aging population and the increased burden on the public sector, that, forgetting about any reform efforts or anything, just steady state with the aging population into the programs that we already have and the taxes in place, negative savings leading to a slower growing economy is exactly the opposite.
Right. Right. So it's exacerbating the fact we have a population, a demographic trend that is only making that problem worse, because one way we're not saving very well right now is a form of what we carry to the future is human capital, not just physical capital. So you can think of when we have less, fewer young people coming into the workforce, which is what's happening now. You know, we have our biggest segment of the population is in the middle of their retirement phase, right? So the youngest of the baby boomers will be retired in 10 more years. So we have this wave of people that are retiring, and the younger cohorts that are coming into the workforce are not as big as those leaving the workforce. So our dependence, our dependence in the population, either the elderly or the young, are in large number relative to the working age population right now.
And elderly would be more inclined to spend and save, so you're probably getting it's a more difficult environment for private savings as the population ages too. So that's another.
Right. So one of the things I studied when I was at working for the Council of Economic Advisors that year was, why did we get into this situation, like where we built up surpluses, right? And because the Clinton administration had come into office when there were large deficits, and by the end of the administration, those deficits had actually changed to surpluses. And of course, we haven't been there since. But a lot of the discussion and the research we did that year was about how did it happen this way. And it's a combination of the natural demographic changes in the economy and economic changes in the macroeconomic changes, and also policy. It's like a mix. It's the interaction of the economy and policy. And some of it is intended policy change, trying to steer the economy more towards surpluses. But some of it was a little luck, too, because we were getting large amounts of revenue coming in the late 90s, because Alan Greenspan said we were being irrationally exuberant about the tech sector, and the stock market was going nuts and, was very happy. The stock market was very happy. So capital gains and dividend income was really high in the late 90s, and that meant capital gains and dividend taxes. Revenues were coming in really high and surprising CBO year after year. Oh, we didn't expect that much. Oh, we didn't expect that much.
Yeah, it was the opposite of what we'd had before, because I was, with the Concord Coalition just starting out at that time. And the surprises every year, we'd keep warning that, whatever deficit projection there was, and it would always come in better. And I can remember the first time my predecessor, Martha Phillips, came into the office. And she had just been to some meeting, and she said, there are people that are seriously talking about a budget surplus within a couple of years. And I said, that is ridiculous. That is just crazy. And within a year, there was a budget surplus. And part of it was, like you said, it was just a very virtuous cycle.
Well, and now I want to jump in, because I've got a burning question. And before I ask it, I want to, sort of recap here for our listeners. And Diane, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the lesson you ultimately took away from those Clinton years was, you know, tax increases can actually be helpful in A, reducing deficits, and also increasing national savings. So did I get that right?
Yes.
So why,
yes.
You know, we've got a growing economy right now. We were on track for a budget surplus and actually saw one at the turn of the century. Why is that same policy perspective, you know, tax increases can help get that deficit down and increase national savings? Why aren't we having that same perspective shared in Congress right now? Why isn't that the policy pursuit?
I mean, politically, it was not an easy case to be made in the late 90s, and now it's even a harder case. So if you think about where we went, at the end of the Clinton administration's message in that economic report was, don't get too excited. You know, we're running surpluses, but this isn't going to last because we have this wave of baby boomers coming up for retirement. And we've been able to kind of ride the baby boom wave while they've been working. But we're about to hit this period of time where we are going to have tremendous spending obligations, and where those baby boomers are going to start to retire, and our tax revenue, our tax base isn't going to be so strong going forward. So don't get so excited about the surplus that we've managed to raise. Don't go and spend it. And so, you know, the Clinton administration was trying to push back against what was already apparently the agenda of the incoming Bush administration. While the Bush administration was still campaigning, we were talking about how, you know, tax cuts, even when we're running surpluses, weren't a good idea. Not because the economy couldn't have handled it at that point in time, but really because we knew that this situation, this really good situation, wasn't going to last, and we needed to kind of save that amount of surplus because it was going to get harder and harder to get to surplus in the future. So the reason why we didn't hold on to it and why we don't have anyone calling for tax increases now is there was no political appetite for that message that, oh, let's be prudent, let's keep hang on to these surpluses, because politicians naturally, if there's a surplus sitting there, they want to give it away. They want to think, oh, that means we can afford to cut taxes, or we can afford to spend more, or we can afford to, you know, kind of increase the deficit because we built up, you know, we've been doing so well the past few years, we can spend some of our good work now. So I think right now the reason why there's no appetite for fiscally responsible tax policy is because the party in charge has no appetite. It's just not part of what they stand for.
I think this is something that we got into a lot in those days, is there's a tendency politically to look at tax and spending policy in separate silos,
yeah,
as if they are not intertwined in,
yeah,
any way. So, you know, you could look at the last tax bill and say there are aspects of it that are, you know, really positive, move things in the right direction. You can argue about how effective it is as a matter of tax reform, but there was really never much question that it would increase the deficit. And people, you know, that were supportive of it would argue, well, spending policy is a different thing. You know, we have to worry about spending on its own, so let's just look at the tax thing. And you can make the opposite argument and say, just let's figure out what we're going to do on the spending side. And you know, that's a different question about how we're going to raise the revenue. So whether or not, and I think this gets back to, Diane, your original point about free lunch, why aren't we doing anything now, is that, you know, people focus on the policy that they want to pursue, and it's easy to fall into the trap of saying it will pay for itself. We don't need to worry about the consequences of it. I like this policy X, and let's not worry about how we're going to pay for it.
Don't rain on my parade.
Yeah, exactly.
My policy, don't muck it up by saying we have to pay for it.
I have one. Unfortunately, we're running short on time, so I've got one quick question for you, and this is sort of putting the economist mom hat back on. How do you break this down? You mentioned there's no political appetite for that kind of policy right now. How do you break this down to the everyday voter and say, look, we need this kind of policy. We need you to act on this and vote for people who push for these kind of policies? Or how do you get them to advocate just in the general public as citizens?
I think we have to remind people that the money has to come from somewhere. You know, when politicians are talking about pushing a new tax cut or continuing a tax cut or pushing for more spending without talking about how it's going to be paid for, everyone has to remember the money has to come from somewhere. Even if it's borrowed, what all that means is that eventually, probably fairly far down the road, our, you know, the younger generation is going to have to face higher taxes or reduced benefits, because there is actually a government budget constraint that isn't just fiction. It's a real budget constraint, because the government is borrowing money by issuing bonds, and those debts have to be honored and repaid when those bonds, you know, when those investments come due. And so I think that the point is not even so much that it's bad for our macroeconomy, it reduces economic growth, which is all true. But the more compelling point for everyday Americans, I feel like, is there's no such thing as you as a parent getting a tax cut that doesn't also mean that your children are going to get a tax increase. You know, like something, you have to think about where the money's coming from. And maybe you conclude that, no, I want my tax cut. I don't care if my kids pay higher taxes in the future. But, you know, you should be aware of how the math works before you go and support your politician for pursuing these policies that are going to only be of short-term benefit to yourself and probably be of long-term cost.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim during our newest segment, The Economist Mom. Thank you, Bob and Diane, for being on the show. Really looking forward to our next Economist Mom segment here in a couple weeks.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Tax cuts don't pay for themselves. A point in keeping with the theme of the show this week. In an era of huge growing deficits, a massive national debt, a strong economy, a large recent tax cut, and discussions of doing another, it's time for this good reminder. Some argue that cutting taxes will generate a level of economic growth sufficient to offset a substantial part, if not all, of the revenue lost. Under this theory, tax cuts do not cause deficits, but generate the growth necessary to reduce them. Yet there is little historic or academic evidence from past decades to suggest that tax cuts alone pay for themselves. There is a healthy debate over the degree to which tax cuts, which allow taxpayers to spend a higher percentage of their income on goods and services, can spur additional economic growth. There have also been helpful attempts to refine how the official government scorekeepers account for revenue loss from tax cuts through so-called, quote, dynamic scoring, which takes into account the budgetary impact of economic feedback. However, two things have remained clear. One, tax cuts don't pay for themselves. And two, revenue loss of tax cuts depends on what taxes are being cut, the state of the economy, and whether tax cuts are paid for by spending cuts. During a recession, policymakers can design short-term tax cuts that get money into the economy quickly, boost economic growth, and wind up leading to less revenue loss than had the very same tax cuts been enacted during a period of economic growth. Policymakers could also enact less well-designed tax cuts during a recession that have little to no impact on the economy. Enacting longer-term tax cuts designed to increase the incentives for work and savings can also lead to increased economic growth. However, if those tax cuts are not paid for by spending cuts, the economic effects of the increase in the deficit can blunt or even completely reverse any positive impact from cutting taxes. When the George W. Bush administration tried to analyze the economic impacts of making their tax cuts permanent, their best case analysis was that only 10% of the cost of the tax cuts would be offset through increased revenue due to heightened economic growth.
Other analysis of the impact of tax cuts from conservative think tanks has found that at most one-third of tax cuts would be offset through increased growth. And consider today's economic growth, with economists and the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, projecting that the recent tax code overhaul is delivering no more than a shot in the arm, with long-term growth falling to less than 2% as challenges like workforce productivity and demographic shifts continue. Tax reform that doesn't increase the deficit and makes the code simpler and more efficient could potentially increase economic growth. However, tax cuts themselves are not a free lunch. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.